Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayetze. This week, Judy Klitzner will discuss Vayetze. Judy Klitzner is a senior faculty member at Pardes, where she has taught courses in Bible and biblical exegesis for nearly 20 years. Judy Klitzner will be launching her new book, Subversive Sequels in the Bible, How Biblical Stories Mine and Undermine Each Other, at Pardes in Jerusalem on Saturday night, December 5th at 8 p.m. You're invited to an evening of learning, music, and celebration. Refreshments will be served, the admission is free, and no RSVP is necessary. Sounds pretty good. You can find out more details about the book launch and about the other places where Judy will be speaking at judyklitzner.com. Her engagements include speaking at Limud New York in January, and you're welcome to join us there. See limudny.org. And now, Judy Klitzner.
Thank you, Larry. I want to talk about a very troubling utterance made by the matriarch Rachel in this week's parasha. She says to her husband, Jacob, here I'll read the verse. This is in chapter 30, verse 1. When Rachel saw that she had borne Jacob no children, she became envious of her sister. And Rachel said to Jacob, "Give me children, or I shall die." This is not the only statement of existential doubt that is made on the part of a matriarch in the book of Genesis. In fact, all the major matriarchs in this book are going to utter similar statements, all of which are very troubling. Rebecca, for instance, says the words, "Im ken lama ze anochi." If this is the case, if my pregnancy is going to be so difficult, why do I exist? Why am I? Later, when she's concerned about the future of one of her children, she says, "Lama li chayim? Why am I alive?" What we'll see soon is that Sarah also is going to say something along these lines, questioning her very existence in the absence of her ability to procreate. It seems then from the matriarchs in Genesis that without childbirth or the success of their children, these women have no purpose for living. Now, this is a very troubling conclusion to reach. We might ask what these verses, what these utterances might have to say about the Bible's view of its women. What are the ramifications within the Bible and beyond the pages of the Bible? Do these passages serve as models for women of all times, that without children they are without purpose? So historically, there have been two basic approaches to difficult questions, and I put this in the category of many difficult questions that are raised by certain statements in the Bible. Sometimes we have moral questions that are raised, certainly in the portion that we read several weeks ago of the binding of Isaac, you know, some very serious, difficult questions that are raised. Here the question that's raised is certain biblical treatment of women and the way that these biblical women see themselves. And there are certain passages that really rankle a modern sensibility. The two basic approaches historically to these types of questions, I would say, the two categories, the first would be apologetics, that if the Bible makes a certain point or a certain statement, there must be some enduring truth to the statement. In this case, perhaps there's some kind of timeless statement about the act of childbirth as actually representing the ultimate definition of woman, maybe even the sole true definition of woman. The other approach, which is almost on the opposite end of the spectrum, would be dismissal, that these words are the product of a patriarchal mindset and they have no relevance whatsoever to the modern reader. What I would like to do here in the brief time that we have is to offer a third approach, which is to see these comments in the broader context of the Bible, what I call the Bible's subversive sequels. Subversive sequel is a term that I have coined, and in fact I have been working on developing a book on this concept over the past 6 years. The book has just been released by the Jewish Publication Society, and it's called Subversive Sequels in the Bible, How Biblical Stories Mine and Undermine Each Other. If you're intrigued by this idea, there will be a launch for this book on December 5th at 8 p.m. at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies here in Jerusalem. What is a subversive sequel? I basically argue that there is a vibrant conversation going on within the passages of the Bible. Biblical stories are in conversation with one another. They often borrow words and themes from one another, which help the two stories interpret each other. But beyond that, often one story will continue another, will act as its sequel. But then, instead of the second story bringing the first to its logical conclusion, as a sequel would generally do, it begins to question the assumptions of the first story, begins to, what I call, undermine the first story, questioning its basic assumptions, and often it begins to rewrite it in dramatically new ways, and often brings it to radically different conclusions. So, getting back to the matriarchs, in order to fully understand these types of statements, these questions, these comments of existential doubt, I believe that we need to see them in a much broader context, to look at the stories of these women in the context of all of the Bible's women. Clearly, we can't do all of that right now, but what we can do is to begin at the beginning and look at this in the context of the Garden of Eden story, the first woman, see how these stories are playing off against those stories, in certain ways act as a subversive sequel to the Garden of Eden. And then what we'll try to do is just give a small taste of how later stories will play upon the stories of the matriarchs and serve in certain ways as their subversive sequels as well. So, to begin at the beginning, we turn to the story of the Garden of Eden. Generally speaking, we are accustomed to speaking of the first couple, first biblical couple, as simply as Adam and Eve. But woman in this story is actually much more complex than this. She doesn't just have one name. She has three names, and these three names point to three separate aspects of her character. The first name that she receives is the name Ha'adam. This is the name that's most frequently overlooked when this woman is analyzed. The first creation of humanity is this creature that contains both male and female within it. Zachar u'nekeva bara otam. Woman is created completely equal to man. She is completely equal before God. Everything that God says to man, God says to woman. Vayomer lahem Elohim. Whatever is true of him, controlling, conquering, is also true of woman. Both are told to be created as God is created. They're both created in God's image. God says to both of them, "Pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply." There's a creativity that is presented in this presentation in the context of godliness. Both man and woman possess a kind of godliness and a kind of godlike immortality. They are going to be able to reproduce themselves forever because of their ability to procreate. That's the first presentation of woman. She is completely empowered. She is just everything that man is, and she is completely equal to him. In addition to that, the next story, chapter 2 of the book of Genesis, suddenly presents a completely different woman. The name that this woman has is Ha'isha. And I would say that this woman actually breaks down into two different elements. On one part of her is that she's derivative of man. God creates her in response to man's loneliness. She is Ezer Kenegdo. She is his helpmate. God says, Lo tov heyot ha'adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. I will create woman to fill that need. So on the one hand, she is derivative of man. She's built from the side of man. Vayiven, God constructs her by removing a side of man and building this new creature from that. But the other side of this woman is that she's also very highly valued. When she's created, man bursts into this rapturous song, this ode to woman, Zot ha'pam etzem e'atzamai. This time, she is bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. This one will be called woman because she was taken from man. In his song, you get both sides of it. Again, he's happy, he's appreciative, he values her, yet she's part of him. She's taken from him. Now, after these two presentations, we have this the chronicle of humanity's disobedience against God. And it's striking that it is the woman who seems to initiate disobedience against God. God has, up until this point, has told man and woman what is good. God has defined everything as ketov. It's in line with what God wants. And as we're about to see, woman is going to redefine Tov as something that God does not want. She looks at the tree and she sees that it is good for eating, and she eats it even though it's something that God does not want human beings to do. Why is it that the woman is susceptible? Why the woman and not the man? And here I would like to suggest, and I elaborate on this greatly in my book, that woman is looking for something that she no longer has, and that is this godlike immortality that we find in the first creation story. Why is it that she is lured by the serpent? Perhaps because the serpent knows what types of claims to make. You will be immortal if you eat from this tree, the serpent says. Lo mot tumultum. You won't die. You'll never die. You'll be godly. You will, he says, be tem ke Elohim. You'll be like God. It's worth it for you to eat this thing. In addition to that, she calls the woman herself, refers to the tree, or she sees the tree as the tree that's in the center of the garden. In fact, the almond tree that is actually described as being in the center of the garden is not the fruit of the tree of knowledge, but rather the tree of life that is in the center of the garden. Perhaps she's thinking of this tree as she reaches for this other tree. She's looking for immortality. She's looking for the kind of majesty that perhaps we saw earlier in her story. And with perhaps feeling a void, she looks to find that in the forbidden tree. In any case, there is this taking, this seeing and taking of something that is not hers to take. And the verbs that are used there, I think, are very significant. Vateve, she sees it. Vateve ha'isha ki tov ha'etz lemachal. She sees that it's good for eating. And then, as a result, vatikach mipirio, she takes from its fruit. As a result of eating from the tree, women's relationships fall apart. In the first instance, her relationship with her husband, this equality that we're first introduced to, now no longer exists. In fact, God now says to the man, "Hishamata l'kol ishtecha, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and ate from the tree that I told you not to eat from, the earth is cursed for you." It is now God's mandate is now not to listen to woman. She will no longer compliment you in certain ways. She's going to be your adversary, and there's going to be a hierarchy. El ishech teshukatech, God says to the woman. To your husband is your desire, and he shall rule over you. This has happened as a result of the disobedience. In addition to woman's relationship with her husband falling apart, her relationship with God also takes a terrible turn. She and her husband are both distanced from God. God asks chastising rhetorical questions of both. God says, Ayeka, to man, where are you? What have you, which really is a rhetorical question. God is not asking for his location. He's saying, what have you done? What has become of you? Where is your godly position? God then asks a rhetorical question of the woman. Ma zot asit, what have you done? How could you have done this? As a result of this, of the estrangement from God, God banishes both man and woman. God banishes them, sends them off from God's presence. And in this context, woman receives her third name. In this case, she's named by man. She's called Chava, which means the mother of all the living. This name also has two aspects to it. On the one hand, it represents grandeur. Childbearing is the greatest possible gift a person could receive. It represents majesty. It represents a godlike ability to create. Yet, and I think perhaps because she had certain positive motives in eating from the tree, the desire for godliness and for immortality, she gets, to some degree, she gets what she was after. She becomes the Im Kol Chai, the mother of all the living. Yet, because she does this against God's wishes, her motherhood, her creativity comes outside of the context of godliness and equality. It becomes her sole definition. This name that's given to her is given as an act of control by her husband. He is the one who now limits and defines her. And now, from this point on, woman is going to need children in order to be considered of value, not only by her husband, but arguably by herself as well. All of this serves as background to the matriarchal stories that we began to look at. The first such story is Sarah, and I want to now just take a few minutes to develop Sarah's story, to see how her story plays off of the Garden of Eden story, and how it sets the stage for later subversive sequels in the Bible. Sarah begins as a chava figure. She is a woman who is defined by her childbearing abilities, but her situation is worse because she's infertile. The text begins by telling us she has no ability to have children. And perhaps as a result, we see that she is marginalized by both God and man. When God speaks to Abraham, he speaks only in the singular, lech lecha me'artecha, go from your land, from your birthplace to the land that I will show you. I will make you singular masculine, you only, Abraham. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. When Abraham responds to God, he gets nervous when he's not having the promised children. He says, Mati kein li, what will you give me? Va'anochi holech ariri, I am childless. He doesn't speak of Sarah at all. I think perhaps as a result of this, Sarah sees herself this way. She is worthless without children. And here is the statement that she makes that I think is similar to the statements that we've seen made by the other matriarchs. When she, in her desperation to have children, turns to her husband and says, I would like you now to have relations with my servant, with my maidservant, Hagar. Sarah says, Ulai ibane mimena. Perhaps I will be built up through her. And I think this is a very powerful statement that she makes that gives us some entry into her mindset that she is formless, she's insubstantial without children. In a sense, she is in the opposite state of the initial woman who was built by God's own hand, by Yivet. God had constructed this woman. Now what she is suggesting is that she is deconstructed because she no longer has the ability to have children. I want to argue that as her story unfolds, perhaps a logical extension of her of exclusion and her feelings of being insubstantial, that the logical extension is her objectification by those around her. She's taken to Egypt by her husband when there's a famine in the land, and the people in Egypt look at her and relate to her as the forbidden fruit in Eden was related to. There, the two verbs that we saw were that the woman saw the fruit and took the fruit. She took that which was not hers to be taken, this object that was attractive. It was overwhelmingly attractive, and so she impulsively took it. Here, the Egyptians, those same two verbs are used to refer to the Egyptians taking Sarah. She now plays the role in this terrible substitution that's made in this story. She assumes the role of the forbidden fruit. She is something to be seen as irresistible in its beauty and is taken even though it is not to be taken. In some sense, Abraham himself is implicated in this story. He sees only her beauty. When they go into the land of Egypt, he says, now I know that you're a beautiful woman. And as a result, he says, please say that you are my sister. He makes his judgment of her based on her outer appearance. And despite the potentially disastrous consequences of the lie that he is about to tell, where he's going to say that she's not his wife, but his sister, she's going to be endangered. They're at risk of being separated possibly forever. Despite all of those risks, he persuades her to enact this act of deception. In addition to this, just as in the garden, there was an ironic definition of the word toh. Human beings saw as good that which God had deemed to be not good. Here Abraham says, please say you're my sister, leman tavli, so that it will be good for me. And there's a further irony in his definition of good, of tov. We know that in the garden, God had said, it's not good for man to be alone, I'm going to make a woman. And here he's looking at his partner, at his female partner. Abraham is looking at her and he's saying, it will be good for me if you say you're my sister. And here he is putting them both into danger of being separated. Here he's saying that it's good that perhaps man and woman being separated might be defined as good. Making matters worse, Abraham does not elicit her response. There's complete silence on the part of Sarah that is very troubling to the reader of this story. Now we might have read this as a sad but inevitable consequence of God's decrees, but the story suddenly veers in a surprising and I would say subversive direction, where the text begins to condemn Abraham in subtle literary ways. First of all, the fact that woman replaces fruit as an object, I think makes the point that if woman is excluded, ultimately she will be objectified. In addition to this, the second, perhaps more surprising substitution that's made here is that the evil Pharaoh The Bible's quintessentially evil king replaces God as man's accuser, judge, and moral superior. In this story, when he finds out the truth that Sarah is, in fact, Abraham's wife and not his sister, he speaks God's language. He says, "Manzot asitali." What is this that you have done to me? Echoing God's words in the garden, "Manzot asit." What have you done? Here, Pharaoh is a man of rhetorical questions, rebuking Abraham. How could you have lied to me in this way? And not only that, he plays God again with the verb that is presented at the end of the story, where "Vayishalhu oto." He sends him off, just as God in the garden had sent off, had cast off, had banished humanity because of their evil deeds, their disobedience. Here, Pharaoh, playing the role of God, is the one who holds the moral high ground and banishes this recalcitrant human being. There's an extra sting at the end. He says, "Hinei ishtecha kach barech." Here is your wife. It's Pharaoh who sets the record straight. She's not your sister. She's your wife, and I want you to leave. Okay, what I'm suggesting here is that these substitutions suggest that Abraham should not have adopted the model of the garden, but he should have begun to question and reverse those conclusions. And here, these subtle reprimands that are given suggest that perhaps Abraham should be recognizing changing circumstances, and he should be meeting the Bible's challenge to move forward. But since he doesn't, since he clings to old models, his narrative, like the narrative of Eden, ends in reprimand and in expulsion. Okay, if we move ahead to chapter 18, a further story of in the larger story of Sarah, I think we have a stepped-up effort to educate Abraham as to women's changing status. Here God enters the picture, and here I think God sends messages through his divine emissaries. This is the story of Abraham meeting God's three messengers in his tent. Abraham is standing at the opening to this tent, which is his natural place of the patriarch engaging the world, who's always ready to receive people. Sarah is back in the recesses of the tent, which seems to be the natural living space of the matriarch. But now God sends messengers that are going to begin to challenge all of these assumptions. The messengers come to Abraham and they ask in words that I think are very resonant of the story of the Garden of Eden. The messengers say, "Aye Sarah Ishtecha, where is Sarah your wife?" Now, aye is a term that is used to mean, as we saw earlier, to suggest a rhetorical question. It's not a full, which is tell me the location. It's why isn't something where it's supposed to be? These messengers of God are challenging Abraham. They're saying to him, "No, don't tell me where she is. Don't tell us where she is. But we demand to know why she isn't here, where she belongs. We're coming here to give you and her word of this impending miraculous event of a child to be born to the two of you at the ages of 90 and 100. Where is she? Why is she not by your side receiving these divine messages?" But Abraham is unaware of the rhetorical intent, and he answers the question as if it had been posed as a simple question. And he says, "Hinei ba'ohel, ba'ohel, she's in the tent. That's where she always is. That's where she belongs. And why should she be anywhere else?" I would suggest that Sarah's perspective on this question of where she belongs becomes clear when the text tells us that Sarah and Abraham were very old. Chadal lihiyot l'Sarah orach kanashim. Sarah had ceased having the ways, the paths of women. What this means literally is she had, simply means she had stopped menstruating. But this term is a very significant term, and I'd like to refer to it later. There's only one other place in the entire Bible where those two words are conjoined. Chadal and Orach. These paths that cease, and I think that those words are going to later constitute the subversive sequel to Sarah's feeling of lack of worth as a result of her infertility. As a result, she says, after I'm withered, I will have no pleasure. Basically, her story ends in tragedy and frustration, yet it has the beginning of the Bible's subversive sequel. As we saw, their narrative makes certain substitutions suggesting that the old models should be questioned, should be challenged. And at the end of the shared narrative between Abraham and Sarah, God, I think in the most direct way, overturns one of the messages of the Garden of Eden when he says to Sarah, to Abraham rather, "Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah shema b'kola." Everything that Sarah says, I want you to listen to her. earlier in the garden, God had said that it's now against God's mandate to listen to woman. And now God is saying that God is defining his mandate as listening to woman. Listen to her in everything that she says. In a sense, she's presented as the superior prophet who's more attuned to God's wishes than even Abraham himself. So God takes certain steps in the matriarchal narratives toward correcting inequalities that man seems to be reluctant to follow. The women of Genesis echo Sarah's frustration, as we saw. Rebecca is going to question her very existence, and Rachel in this week's portion is going to give the most extreme utterance to this effect, when she's going to say, "Havali banim ve'im ayin met anachi." Bring me children, for if not, I am dead. These sentiments will be fully challenged later in a book that is the most subversive book, I think, in the Bible. It brings a radical counterweight to the stories of these matriarchs, and that is the book of Judges. The pendulum is going to swing fully in the opposite direction, and here specifically in the story of Deborah. I think this story is interested more in parody of these stories than it is in parity between the sexes. It presents this almost farcical counterweight to the stories that we've seen, where instead of the men being spiritually attuned, instead of the men understanding what has to happen, it's the women. They are completely disempowered. The women are the ones who are the religious, military leaders, as we see in the story of Deborah and Yael. The woman is a political assassin. The women are the ones who receive God's word. Men are completely dependent on them for prophecy and for leadership. In a radical re-scripting of the matriarchal narrative, Deborah, whose story includes no reference whatsoever to children, calls herself an Ein B'Yisrael. In her song, she says, "Ad Shakamti Ein B'Yisrael, I am a mother in Israel." This is nothing less than a radical redefinition of motherhood itself. A woman who has no children on record speaks of herself as a mother. She's a mother in different ways. She's a mother by prophesying, by leading her people into war, by leading her people on their spiritual quest. She's a mother of a completely different sort. In addition, Deborah sings out, "In the days of Yael," she says, "Chadelu arachot, paths ceased." Okay, here is our second and the only other case in the Bible where these words appear together. Paths ceased. She's talking about the paths of the Israelites, but I believe that there is a double entendre intended here, where she's also talking about the paths of women. That in a subversive rewriting of Sarah's story, Sarah, who had felt that there was only one legitimate path to fulfillment and legitimacy, and that was through childbirth, but Sarah, who couldn't be fulfilled that way because chadal liot l'sara orach kanashim, she had ceased having the ways of women. Sarah's paths were completely cut off. But Deborah now proclaims that when certain paths are blocked, there are always other paths to explore. And she uses the term, there are yelchu derachim akal kalot. You can go in circuitous paths. With her choice of words, Deborah strongly hints that even when traditional pathways are closed off, for both the Israelites and arguably for women, there are new paths, unorthodox, unexpected, and previously even unimagined to pursue. Woman's story in the Bible, in all, her story is one of many-fold paths. Women of Genesis, the women in Genesis present one extreme. The women in the book of Judges, in many ways present the opposite extreme. And in fact, to conclude this subversive reworking of the book of Genesis on the question of women, Deborah at the end of her song says, "Ni nashim ba'ohel tevorach," that these women are, that Yael, this very powerful woman, is blessed. She is blessed even more than are the women in the tent. Women who have no children, in this rendering of women's story, they're not dead. They're not lacking in any kind of substantial standing in the world. They are not deconstructed. In fact, in the words of Deborah, women who develop their potential outside of the tent, such as Yael and such as Deborah, they're blessed, perhaps even more than are the women of the tent. Ultimately, the Bible will present middle positions, not just these two extremes. in which women will have all kinds of potential, both inside and outside of the tent, both with and without children. The anguished cries of the matriarchs are but particular points on a very broad spectrum that unravels throughout the Bible. The subversive sequels expose the story of biblical women as complex, as a story that is as complex and as varied as that of biblical man. And here, if I may conclude by doing something that I've waited 6 years to do, I would like to read a paragraph from my book, the last paragraph, in fact, which says the following. The subversive sequel is a useful narrative model for the unfolding story of feminine achievement. As the Bible repeatedly sets up its paradigm and then takes artful aim at them, woman's story is constantly under review. In fact, no biblical woman may be labeled the definitive biblical woman. In the expansive gamut of her occupations and preoccupations, biblical woman is righteous and she is wicked. She is martial leader and she is chattel. She is a victim of rape and violence, and she is the perpetrator of sexual harassment and violence. Woman is prophet and prostitute, midwife and murderer, maidservant and monarch, litigant and judge, poet, songstress, and blessedly, the mother of all the living.
Thank you, Judy. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.